Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live, and we are so excited this morning to talk about the Ouija board with Linda Rodriguez, who is a fantastic writer, writes for the Smithsonian. And I'm sure many of you out there have stories. We're already having people send in their stories with the Ouija board. I know when I was a boy, my mother and I used to get it out and we'd ask it questions. Then I got involved in the church and Christianity, very heavy fundamentalist Christianity, and they told me to get rid of it and renounce it and everything. But Linda's article investigates the whole history of the Ouija board and brought up a lot of interesting things about its background. And it's been a pretty scary thing. I saw a horror movie recently called, I think it was just called Ouija, about some young teenagers playing with it. And you may recognize this music from The Exorcist. That was a movie in which I believe the Ouija board was a portal to evil. So we'll be back in about 20 seconds with the writer of this great piece from the Smithsonian, the strange and mysterious history of the Ouija board. We'll be back with Linda here shortly on Richard Rossi Live. Thank you for tuning in. And as always, you can send in your questions and text to richardrossilive@gmail.com. Be back in 20 seconds. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. And welcome from across the pond, Linda Rodriguez McGrabe. How are you?
Hi, thanks. I'm good. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, how did you get involved covering the weird stuff for Smithsonian?
I've been fairly lucky in my career path. You know, the things that I find weird, evidently other people also find weird and interesting. So far, so good. But I've just always been really interested in some of these sort of strange stories and things like the Ouija board, you know, which definitely everything has a history, and I just tend to be one of those people who finds that history really interesting.
Yeah, your article starts off, and by the way, I want to thank Professor Rebecca Stein in the anthropology department at Los Angeles Valley College, who teaches a course in anthropology of religion, witchcraft, magic. She is the reason I found your article. And your article starts off about a shop in Pittsburgh. I don't know if that's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, but this is going back to 1890. Was it Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
It was. Oh. It was an advert in a Pittsburgh newspaper for a Pittsburgh toy and novelty shop that first began advertising for this magical device.
Mm. Well, growing up there, it was a big deal. There were a lot of urban legends about it. I went to a Catholic grade school, and I remember the teachers talking about it and their experiences and people that got answers from it. And we were going to move, or we were trying to move, and there were problems with the house and the contractor, and my mom was all stressed out. Are we going to move or not? She pulled out the Ouija board, and I remember us asking, are we going to move? But your article says that this kind of started from capitalism and spiritualism and someone trying to kind of capitalize. I guess spiritualism and seances and all this thing was real big. Even Abraham Lincoln's wife, they lost a child, and you talk about that. Can you give us some of the history and background of how this whole thing started?
Absolutely. Spiritualism as a movement became incredibly popular in the middle of the 19th century. It was already fairly popular over here in Europe. There still are spiritualist churches and temples. But the idea was that people could...
Oh, sounds like I lost Linda. You still there, Linda? Oh, I lost Linda. I hope she calls back in. Just looks like she died. We may be having some technical difficulty because Linda's dropped. She's Skyping from across the pond. Okay, we got her back.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, Linda, sorry about that. We lost you for a few seconds. So you were talking about
spiritualism
was very big.
Yes, so spiritualism was really big over here. And the idea was that over here and then later in the U.S. in the middle of the 19th century, the idea was that people could communicate with their departed loved ones, people who had died. And you know, it's sort of an interesting phenomenon that occurred right around the same time that communication was getting faster and easier with all parts of the world. So the idea sort of was that if you could communicate with, you know, people via telegraph, why couldn't you communicate with the dead? All things were possible, and it was this wonderful time of the kind of marriage between science and spiritualism and an approach to what happens after we die being kind of investigated by scientific people. But spiritualism served a real need for people at a time when the average lifespan was around 50 years. You know, people die very early. There were a number of epidemics of disease that killed people, wars killed people. So their loved ones who were left behind wanted to communicate with them. And in the U.S., it became a real fad that started with the Fox sisters in upstate New York. And they were a trio of sisters who said that they could communicate with spirits by rapping. They could interpret the knocks on a wall as answers from a spirit. Finally, it turns out that one of the sisters was able to crack her toes at will, which sounds really gross and kind of weird, but was actually what she was doing. She later admitted that it was all sort of a big hoax. And the sad reality was that
the Fox sisters
were
kind of a fraud then, the Fox sisters?
Yes. Yeah, they were. And you really find out, too, that, you know, most of these seances and mediums and spirit mediums and people like that were frauds. You know, they had some fairly elaborate ways of perpetuating their hoaxes, but they were really frauds. And I think it's really kind of sad how much they were kind of tapping into a need that people felt to connect with something bigger than them or connect with their loved ones who died, and were capitalizing on that in a sort of mercenary way. But some people also actually really believed in what they were doing. Some spirit mediums did believe that they were actually connecting. And so the Ouija board was this device that was sort of a DIY spiritual medium program. Like you could buy this board from about 1891 and take it home, and you and your family, without needing a spirit guide or a medium or anybody in kind of the middleman way, and, you know, you could connect with the beyond.
Yeah, because it costs a lot of money. Like the psychic hotlines and people that do these things are paying all this money. If there could be a way to just do it on their own. And by the way, if you're just tuning in late, we're with Linda Rodriguez McRobbie, the author of the book Princesses Behaving Badly and writer for the Smithsonian. We're talking about the Ouija board, and her website is lindarodriguezmcrobbie.com. So it's a DIY, you were saying, a way that, with all these people doing the seances, including the White House, and that they could get this board instead of having a medium answer the questions, they just do the board.
Exactly. I mean, and around the same time, there were a number of other sort of similar objects that had come out. And the Ouija board actually wasn't the first, quote, talking board of its kind. But it was certainly the most successful and obviously the one that's been the most enduring. But there were other sort of systems. I mean, people did automatic writing. People did what's called table turning, where they would all put their hands on a table. You know, a group of people would sit around and put their hands on a small table, which sort of Victorian London and contemporary America were just littered with these weird, small, kind of useless side tables. So they had these little tables, and they would turn off the lights and make everything very spooky, and the table would start to move as they asked questions. Now, in reality, what was happening with things like automatic writing or the table turning or the Ouija board is down to something that's called the ideomotor effect.
Yeah, the ideomotor effect, and that's very interesting, is that there's somehow a subconscious thing that we do that's influencing it. Am I understanding that right? Or I know they've been experimenting.
Exactly. So the ideomotor effect has been a documented sort of thing since about 1852, when at the time a physician and physiologist, William Benjamin Carter, published a report for the Royal Institute of Great Britain examining what were these automatic muscular movements that take place without the will of the individual. So the person doesn't really know that they're moving, but they're doing it. So we do a lot of these things all the time. We breathe, obviously, but also we cry in reaction to a sad movie. We flush when we feel embarrassed or our heart starts pounding and we get scared. And these are sort of automatic movements that we're not really in control of. And so what they were seeing is at the time there was this sort of great rash of the table turning and things like that. And one of the sort of foremost chemists and physicists of the day, Michael Faraday, began investigating them in terms of the ideomotor effect. And he conducted a series of experiments that proved to him that what was really happening when table turning or automatic writing or something like that was being employed was the ideomotor effect. So again, it's these small involuntary muscular movements that when used in combination with something like table turning actually has sort of a larger effect. You know, so you've got, or say with the Ouija board, you've got a small planchette, the device that you push around the board to spell out the letters. And just kind of even a small guiding movement, is enough to have a sort of large effect. And that makes it feel like you're not moving it, but it's moving. And, you know, so there have been a number of other experiments investigating this, and all of them pretty much come down to the conclusion that it is the ideomotor effect. Now, what that is, though, can be really interesting, and what's controlling these automatic movements, I think, is where some of the directions of current psychological experiments are going with it.
So fascinating. In the fundamentalist world, and many of us have heard this being an evil thing. I have a comment from a friend coming in that from Lonnie Johnson in Mississippi. He says, "Rich, I can tell you things about those boards that will make your hair stand on end. Used one from over 12 years. It was almost 98% accurate. When I destroyed it, definitely a demonic spirit was seen escaping the board." I got involved as a teenager in the evangelical world where they told me, you know, get rid of this board. It opens the door to demons. It's forbidden in the Bible. Your article says that the view that this is a very evil thing grew, if I remember correctly, that in the 50s, I think you might have mentioned an episode of Lucy's Show where it was more like a fun game, but then The Exorcist and some of the other films, you know, really in popular culture associated with Satan. Was the perception of it as being an evil thing, is that something that has grown through our popular culture?
Yes. So my understanding from the historian that I spoke to, a guy called Robert Murch, who's done a lot of really fascinating and kind of the most important research on the topic of Ouija boards when no one else had done, he really sort of says that there's a very clear line that before The Exorcist, you know, the boards were a bit spooky and a little bit kind of, you know, woo, but they weren't evil. And then after The Exorcist, that was when popular culture really started to hone in on the idea that the Ouija board could be a portal to hell. And it's interesting because when you look at the kind of popular culture mentions of the Ouija board before The Exorcist, you know, in most of those cases, it's a fairly innocent thing. I mean, you've got, you know, Norman Rockwell, you know, painted the classic Thanksgiving
scenes
and things like that.
Yeah.
He you know, painted an image for the Saturday Evening Post of two people on a Ouija board. So it was very much something that wasn't, if it wasn't exactly wholesome, it wasn't bad, it wasn't harmful. And in some ways, people found that it was somewhat compatible with Christian theology. I mean, in a sense that sort of people kind of massage many behaviors into becoming compatible with Christian theology. It was not considered a really bad thing to do. Now, after The Exorcist, when you had that depiction of a little girl being possessed by a spirit and by a demon, and that being a very shocking film at the time, I mean, it really was a big kind of game changer, I think, in scary movies. It was also, you know, one of the first times where people explicitly made a connection between the Ouija board and potential demonic possession. But after that, you sort of had the floodgates open and you know, a number of films coming out that show kids, especially, it's usually like, you know, in the sort of pretty popular horror film equation, I suppose. I guess the word I'm looking for is maybe kind of scenario where you've got a mixed group of teenagers probably getting up to no good and drinking and maybe even having sex, things like that, and they will pull out a Ouija board and sort of in answer to the things that they've done wrong, the spirit comes to the board and you know, starts picking them off. These films became really, really popular, and so at the same time you see an uptick in televangelists being very much against it. You see an uptick in things like burning the Ouija board. You see a major uptick in people denouncing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a film I just saw not that long ago. I think it was 2014, the Ouija about the teens. And the title of the film, I think, was Ouija. And, it was really a pretty scary film.
Yeah, and I mean, it comes up even now, you know, sort of all the time as this, you know, it's almost synonymous with portal to hell. You know, this is how the demons get in, kind of thing. And, you know, Paranormal Activity 1 and 2 both had a Ouija board. So it's, you know, it's become fairly grounded in the horror genre. And I think that's really had an influence on how people in general see it.
Mm. Yeah, and people have used it, too, that want to exploit that. Like Alice Cooper, I was reading for years, claimed that he got the name Alice Cooper from a Ouija board session in a 17th century witch, had that name and then mm-hmm. later, I think, admitted it was kind of a publicity stunt. He had a brilliant PR man named Shemp Gordon that just knew how to shock everyone and get everyone talking as kids about Alice Cooper, you know.
It works.
Yeah, it really does work. There's an experiment you mentioned where they had someone with a Ouija board thinking there was another person in the room doing it with them, and then they get all these answers beyond their own conscious mind showing
them.
Could you tell us about that experiment?
Absolutely. I think that's one of that's certainly the place where you kind of see the usefulness in a way of people being put in a state where they're sort of almost on automatic pilot, where they've relinquished voluntary control and are sort of in their own non-conscious thought. So basically what the experiment was, done by the University of British Columbia's Visual Cognition Lab. And in the first iteration, they had the subject, sitting down and playing the Ouija board against a robot. And they told the subject that the robot was being manipulated by someone in another room. So the person believes that they're actually playing with another person. In reality, the robot was just, all it was doing was sort of amplifying the movements of the subject itself. So, you know, if the person would move it a bit, then the robot would kind of respond and help move it a little bit more. Now, what they found was that when you ask people a series of questions, yes or no questions that they may or may not know the answer to, and were guessing, they got it right about 50% of the time. But when they were answering with the help of the robot, which, again, was just them, only their movements, they answered it with about a 65% success rate. So what that revealed to the researchers was that your non-conscious mind, to sort of use kind of the best working term, seems to know a lot more than we give it credit for, or at least has different ways of processing information that could potentially be investigated by using something like a Ouija board. Now, subsequent iterations of this particular experiment have actually used another human, and what they've done is had the subject sit down at the Ouija board and be blindfolded, and they'll be sat opposite another person who is, you know, actually sort of in on the experiment. And at some point during the experiment, the other individual takes their hands off. So again, the subject is left alone with the planchette and the Ouija board and their own kind of non-conscious mind responding to the question. So, you know, what's interesting about it, again, is that it's helping us investigate the different levels and ways that we process information. And it's opening up an avenue of exploration that probably wouldn't have been really considered, you know, in, I mean, you know, these guys at University of British Columbia got the idea because they'd been, they'd had a Ouija board out at a Halloween party and kind of, you know, messing about with it. And later they thought, hey, this is actually kind of a cool thing. Like maybe we can work on this. Maybe we can figure something out with it. So hopefully, I mean, it seems like a really kind of fascinating way to look at the information that we don't really know we know.
So they're accessing, it seems like they're accessing things that they didn't realize they knew?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of widely accepted that we have different levels of information processing. And, you know, some parts of our brain are better at doing some things, making quick decisions, perceiving hazards, for example, on the road, or being able to answer questions quickly. And that it's almost like, I mean, if you've ever felt like if you think about something too much, you're overthinking it and you don't quite get it right. Mm-hmm. It's almost like that in a way. You know, I had an experience with my son the other day when I asked him, he's 4.5 and he doesn't quite know how to read yet. He's getting there. But I asked him to look at a word and tell me what he thought it was. And he said the word immediately. The word was blue. And I was like, that's great. You know, how did you know that? And he said, I don't know how I knew that. He didn't really, you know, instead of trying to do it again, he didn't really quite know. It was clear that he didn't quite know how to read, but some part of his brain did recognize that that word was blue. And when he said it very quickly, it was almost as if his sort of non-conscious mind was responding and he was saying blue. So I think, you know, the Ouija board as an opportunity to explore it is a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's an inspirational speaker, Barbara Sharon. She does a technique where she'll have people, she's entrepreneurs or creative people, list their heroes. So maybe an actor puts down Marlon Brando, or maybe as a writer you put down your five favorite writers. You know, I don't know, Hemingway or who, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then she does a game where when they reach a crisis or a writer's block or something like that, they use their imagination to imagine, you know, what would your artistic heroes tell you to do, and they get all kind of great, you know, advice, and it, you know, kind of unblocks them and things like that. But it's
mm-hmm.
really just kind of accessing something in themselves that they really do have by pretending that they're talking to imagining what their hero would say to inspire them, you know. So
exactly.
It seems like there's something in us that we don't tap into in terms of our inner subconscious sometimes.
And it's interesting, too, because there were a number of people throughout the 20th century who used the Ouija board to say, well, there were several famous people who did it, where they said that they were writing stories and poems and things like that that were dictated by spirits via the Ouija board. Now, the sort of big case was in 1916, when there was a woman called Pearl Curran who said that she began writing these poems and stories that she said were dictated by the spirit of a 17th century English woman called Patience Worth. Now, her stories became really popular, and she was really earning a lot of accolades for what she was doing. And, you know, you sort of see this coming up several times over the 20th century, and in particular in 1982, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet James Merrill did it again, with The Changing Light of Sandover, which won the National Book Critics Circle. Now, he said he sort of said, you know, he had the Ouija board, and it was kind of the hotline to the spirits that was, you know, transmitting these ideas and these thoughts. But later on, when he wrote another book, he said, and I just love this quote because I think it's really kind of, you know, wonderful when you think about it. He said, if the spirits aren't external, how astonishing the mediums become. And so the idea that if it isn't a spirit and it is you, how wonderful that you've achieved this and that you're doing it. So what do you know that you don't know that you know?
The Patience Worth is interesting too, because this writer, I guess the character, it's from another century, 17th century, and they, you know, she supposedly knew all these things that she, you know, claim she couldn't have known about that time,
mm-hmm.
that period. And then others say, no, she knew some of these people from there. What do you think? Do you think it's, you know, what do you think about that?
I mean, I tend to come sort of very squarely down on the side of it's not spirits, and that, you know, again, if anything, it shows that we know more than we think that we know. You know, one of the things that I found really interesting after writing this story was that a number of people will come up and say things like, I was playing on the Ouija board and we asked it some questions, you know, we asked the spirit some questions that there's no way that they couldn't have known the answer to, that we didn't know the answer to. You know, it says things like, you know, my deceased aunt's favorite cat, how'd they know the answer to that? Well, if you didn't know the answer to it and no one knew the answer to it, then no one really knows the answer to it. So it could be anything. I mean, so, you know, you have a lot of people trying to sort of sort things out through layers of memory and knowledge, and there's a lot of gray areas, and the Ouija board kind of works really well in that vagary, almost, that, you know, people do want to believe that it's a spirit. They do want to believe that they're being communicated with by someone from the other side. They don't necessarily want to think that they're in control, and they don't necessarily want to know that they know all these things, or that someone else at the table does, or that perhaps they're just making it up as they go along. And, you know, so I don't think that it's spirits. I've never had an experience that would lead me to believe that it was spirits. So should leave it at that.
It's interesting, too, because we've been getting people writing to us about the show and about how, you know, warning us about how, you know, of these terrible, evil things that happen through the Ouija board. And in most of the cases, when we ask, well, tell us what happened, what was your experience, 99% of the time it's an urban legend or someone told them in their church, mm-hmm. or a friend of a friend of a friend. But very few, with the exception, I did have a guy write in I quoted earlier, very few seem to have these first-person stories of something mm-hmm. like that. So there's this urban legend thing that goes on with it, I think, where people you know, talk about all these stories, and it gets very, very scary and dramatic.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and the function of urban legends in quite a lot of ways is to reinforce social values and social norms. So messing about with the spirit world should have consequences, we think. You know, sort of socially, culturally, we think that it shouldn't be okay to do that. So when you tell these stories that, you know, my friend's cousin was playing about with it and she got into a car accident the day after and, you know, things like that, you know, you're really just sort of saying, you're reinforcing the kind of cultural narrative that these things aren't okay, that you shouldn't be able to get away with talking to spirits. And so, you know, an urban legend really has, you know, a function, and that's its function. I do think that there are people who very much have had experiences with a Ouija board that they believe to be exceptional and strange. And even people that I've talked to who are, you know, scientists investigating this will admit that they've had some weird experiences with it. But again, I mean, I sort of keep coming back to James Merrill's quote, if the spirits aren't external, how astonishing the mediums become. I very much believe that it's coming from inside you.
Mm. Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned in the Christian theology side, that's, you know, I think sometimes a lot of, particularly in some of the Pentecostal churches I've seen, they want everything to externalize. You know, Flip Wilson, a comedian mm-hmm. years ago, used to blame, well, the devil made me do it. So, if mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it's, you know, we don't want to look at maybe what's really inside us that's the problem, but, you know, we want to say the devil made me do it. And so
yeah.
It's been a fascinating article. And by the way, oh, my word, it's went so quick. They're telling me we got a minute left. So the best place to reach, to see your work is LindaRodriguezMcRobbie.com and Smithsonian.com?
Yeah, I haven't updated my website in a while, but Smithsonian.com, I think, has some of my more recent stuff on it. And I will get around to updating my website, I promise. So if somebody comes to visit it soon, it should be fixed.
Wow. Well, you did a tremendous job writing this article, and
Thank you.
We can't wait to keep reading more of your work. And I think all of you, particularly the women, will enjoy Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings. What a fascinating book you wrote there about these great myths of these powerful and true, you know, the various stories of all these great, these true stories of great women.
Thank you.
Well,
thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, you're most welcome, and enjoy your family, and all the best to you and your husband and your two little boys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda. And thank you to all of you for listening today. What an interesting show. I got rid of my Ouija board, as I said, as a teenager, with the churches telling me it was so evil. I don't plan to get it back or play around with it, but I have to say I'm very interested in this whole scientific thing that Linda talked about, this ideomotor response. How fascinating. And she has a great article. If you want to read her whole article, by the way, we have about 5 seconds left, just Google Smithsonian Linda Rodriguez, and the title is The Strange and Mysterious History of the Ouija Board. Very great in-depth article. And thank you for joining us. God bless each and every one of you. We are so grateful for the support of the show. And tomorrow we have a great show. Tune in tomorrow at 11 a.m.